from our hometown.
Definitely. Well, let's start with kind of the origins of where this all came from. I mean, did you guys kind of conceive of this a while back? I mean, how did this crazy idea come about?
David, why don't you take that? Yeah, you know, the story starts actually about 25 years ago when we made a short film with this same subject, but it was a short film. It was not a documentary. It was just the story of these three astronauts who come down in the desert rather than in the Pacific Ocean the way they usually do, Apollo astronauts back in 1973. And that short went on the festival circuit and did great. And then at the time, we thought, well, what if we waited a little bit longer, maybe even a lot longer, and revisited the story, but this time maybe in the context of a documentary? And 25 years passed, quickly, as it does, and we basically called back up the band and asked everybody if they wanted to get back together to do this. But, you know, essentially we had to prove that it was possible first. And the way that we did that we shot an interview with Don Hanna, our producer and the guy who plays Bo Cunningham. And we did 5 days of interviews up at his house on Telluride over the Christmas holidays. And if that worked, then we thought, well, maybe we have a chance at doing something interesting. And it did work. And after we shot those interviews, we thought, well, we've come this far, we should keep going. And so we then shot the other interviews as well and started to build essentially what was a documentary.
And this is Mark talking. I can't express enough how important those initial interviews with Don Hanna as Bo Cunningham were, because he really committed an act of real method acting there. I mean, he didn't have a script. You know, David and I prepared questions, and I sat down and interviewed him, but he responded completely in character and explored the events of 25 years earlier very much in character as that person, and provided, you know, the spine for how we would go about everything else. Now, everybody else, a lot of the other actors, did have lines written for them, although we, you know, got off book fully, and we encouraged everybody to sort of go off on their own. There's some interesting things about that as well. But it was Don's ability to really inside this guy and to prove that you could do something that was it was absolutely real and absolutely believable in the context of this sort of extraordinary event.
Guys, how do you wait from 92 to 2015? That's wild. Your whole lives must have changed. Everyone's lives.
We were busy. Fortunately, we weren't. We were doing other things. But it's a remarkable thing. I had been actually editing and directing Russian language romantic comedies in Moscow in the past few years, and I had gotten back from Moscow after being there for a long time, and was desperate to do something in English. And that's when I called up Mark and said, you know, what we were thinking about with the landing, this may be the time.
Yeah, because everybody's still alive, you know.
Yeah, everybody's still alive. And moreover, everybody still fit into their costumes. So that was a good thing. But yeah, it was a brave thing to undertake, because you march down that road and you don't know what's at the end of that road. Just go and start walking, and you hope that you arrive someplace interesting. And fortunately, I think we did.
Yeah, and this is Mark again. The amount of time that passes in a way is not really as important as the moment you find yourself in when you set off on this project. So, you know, the story was there. We were exploring the story, and not just through the people who participated in the original film, but in new cast members who played people we had never seen before. But also in terms of reading the times and sort of seeing sort of where we've come in the media, you know, ecosystem. You know, there's a lot to be concerned about right now in terms of so-called alternative facts and fake news. And technologically, we're at a point where any of those things can be done, and be done in a technically convincing manner. So, you know, it very quickly became obvious to us that the landing could be sort of a cautionary tale about what you can do, you know, with the worst of intentions. You know, we had nothing but good storytelling intentions, but a person, you know, a less honorable person, sociologically, culturally, and politically, could obviously use these same tools. And so it became sort of a testbed for that kind of thing, and that's something which actually kind of disturbs us.
Yeah, we see that happening, obviously, today, you know, all around us in our current American life. And there's a, you know, tangentially, the other thing which is alarming is that it's not only relatively easy to convince people of something that happened, or convince them that something did happen. It's also relatively easy to reshape their memories, to actually take something that they think they know and to recast it into something else. We have had people in screenings come up to us afterwards and say, you know what? I think I remember this.
Wow.
How they can remember it is kind of remarkable because, you know, obviously it never happened. And presenting it in such a way and harnessing the standards of talking head documentaries, you quickly understand that the people, they will go where you take them, if you do it well. And I think that that's something that a person has to be mindful of, not just as an audience member, but as a filmmaker. You have to take responsibility for what you do, and now more than ever.
Yeah, I mean we're in a documentary saturated world now. You know, I mean I mean everyone has access to the tools of documentary filmmaking. I mean, no one would ever thought, you know, even, you know, what year the iPhone came out, 2007. You know, that you know, 10 years later, almost every human being on the planet will be walking around with a movie camera in their pocket, and so we can all document our lives, and all of us are documenting our lives, and whether it's people's personal YouTube channels or, you know, things that they post on Twitter, you know, we're getting very, very used to seeing other people's storytelling about their lives and their environments. And so being able to discriminate and think critically about what it is that you're seeing is going to be one of the most basic tools that we have to have, that people have to have going forward in the decades ahead. Because, you know, we're not only going to be able to, not only are we watching other people's stories and having to decide whether those stories are true or how much of them are true, but the tools are increasingly being handed to people to make changes to those realities. And I don't want to get all, you know, sort of freaked out here. But, I mean, you know, the upcoming iPhone has something called Portrait Feature, which allows people to change the lighting and the backgrounds entirely in the pictures they take to create a sort of a version of the picture they've just taken, which is technically far superior to the original picture, but it's actually just a complete computer-generated, you know, reshaping of that picture, and it's done just with a couple of taps. Well, that's the beginning, folks. I mean, that's where it's headed, and it won't take 2 years like it took David and I to create our, you know, fake news, so to speak. People will be doing it, you know, on the fly. They're walking around, and that's the other, you know, sort of part of the cautionary tale that the landing, I think, really is.
Wow, it's so true, and I, you know, when I was watching this film, I didn't think towards documentaries. I thought towards fiction films. I thought of like Wag the Dog showcases this a lot about fake wars, and there was a movie a couple of years ago, Operation Avalanche, which was talking about the fake moon landing. But you guys meticulous work on one of the things I love are like the photos in the film and the actual reports. Can you talk about just all of the extra material that you guys created for this film? I mean, yes. This must have been its own project.
Yes, it was.
This is David. The film was sort of made in I was going to say in a couple of stages, but it really was made in sort of all at the same time, because when you were editing, you would realize that we needed something here, for example, we need a photo to show this. And then we'd have to embark on a whole research expedition all through NASA archives and stock footage archives and find something that we could use, to fulfill whatever the storytelling moment required. And that was probably the greater percentage of the making of the film, was that research and that work on the photos, on the archival photos.
And just to clarify how that works, we went into all of our cast. We went into their family photo albums. I drove around the country going to these different actors' houses and flying across the country to look through bins and albums, and literally, would go home with thousands of pictures that we would sort through and look for, pictures which might be useful down the road as part of photoshopping and computer-generated imagery that we didn't necessarily know what we would need down the road. So as David said, when we realized we needed a certain picture, we would find, something from the NASA archives and then go into our archive of our actors' pictures from 25 years ago and find things which was promising to sort of start that project. And it was the same thing with the documents, which you mentioned, all the letters and telegraphs and reports from the CIA and that kind of thing. We didn't just put a piece of paper in the typewriter and type something up. We have to go research using Freedom of Information files, actual period memos and forms and that kind of thing, and we take actual memos and forms and then find the exact font of that exact typewriter and then find that typewriter in a thrift shop here in LA and then create sort of a template and then put it to the typewriter and type it so it actually had three-dimensional impact when you saw it. So it was that kind of thing was, as David said, it was almost, if you added that up, probably the greater percentage of the work. The actual cutting and the storytelling and determining how you're going to tell the story, because it was kind of exactly like a documentary. You had all these interviews and you had to shape it into the exact story. But the creation of all the supporting evidence, so to speak, quote unquote, that was extremely time consuming and exhausting. Because as you point out, it had to be dead on. It couldn't look half-assed.
Well, I was blown away by it. I mean, halfway through, I was like, I know going into this what it is, and I'm still saying, how the hell did they do that? Where did they get this from? So another element that I really loved... go ahead, guys.
I was just going to make a note that there were a couple of occasions in which we had to take the original 16mm footage that was shot 25 years ago, and we would need to repurpose it for a certain storytelling point. And so we would go out and we would shoot 16mm footage of one of us in a different costume, but with a green hood on, so that we could, with VFX, apply new wardrobe to previous shots. So there was a lot of this whole jigsaw puzzle of elements that went back and forth. That had to be dealt with, and so we weren't just dealing with 16mm film, we were dealing with 8mm film, we were dealing with digital imagery, we were dealing with still photographs, with archival footage. It was an immense collection of elements that had to be wrestled down, we're still catching our breath.
You could teach a class on just all the elements of what you guys used. I've got to ask another element that I really loved about the film. Kind of it almost acted as kind of the interlude moments or the moments to take you into the next sequence was the music and the choice in songs. Can you talk about working with Brian about the feel, obviously the time frame of when you guys were picking music, and just about, along with that, also the darkness of the score that would go along with it, because you guys also utilized, kind of a haunting score to help out keep the eerie nature of the film as well.
I'll talk about Brian. Just because Brian is a remarkable composer, and he worked for many years on Family Guy, and he also scored several of the movies that I made in Russia, these rom-coms. So he has a really amazing, you know, broad talent for orchestration, for melody, and for genre. And when you in this business, it's all too common for people to get to be typecast or pigeonholed. But if a person has talent, usually they can apply it in just about any direction. And so we felt that Brian would just make lunch out of this kind of a story. And especially since he'd been doing things like rom-coms, he was hungry to do something different. And we always loved the organic analog synth sound of a lot of movies from the 70s. And thought that, well, as a matter of texture, as a matter of you know, period reference, and a synth sound might be really cool. And so Brian just bit into us like a dog with a bone. He went out and he bought and researched all kinds of Moog synthesizers and analog synths that nobody had used in years, including a thing called a Swarmatron, which Trent Reznor uses a lot. And he basically performed, because they're analog, he performed these on a multitude of keyboards, in a sense, live. He would play and perform to a cue and then go back and play and perform the next level of the cue, adding layers, adding counterpoint and melody, until he had built up the score. And he really tapped into the emotional darkness that's suggested by the story. He's just brilliant that way. So we couldn't be happier, and there's frankly nobody else that I can imagine that would have rather had do the music for the score than Brian. And then he also, as you noticed in the film, you know, there's about six or seven pop songs, so to speak, from the period. Those are all licensed from the respective publishers, but one of them, San Francisco, you know, the John Phillips Scott McKenzie song, that one, I won't go into all the details, we could only get the sync rights for that song and not the rights for the master, so we had to record our own, and Brian produced that recording, and we actually went into Studio 3 at East West here in Hollywood, which is the exact room where Lou Adler and Phillips and Scott McKenzie recorded the original. And we used the exact microphones that were still there in that studio through the exact same boards. Through the exact same boards. I know, it was from 1967 to 68. It was really extraordinary, and Brian just again, knocked that one out of the park, too, because it's a really beautiful recording, and you know, the music is I mean, David and I are film music freaks and have been since we were kids, and so the music was something which was always going to be important, and you know, whether it was the montages to those songs which helped really place you there in the period, or whether it was the score, I mean, it was you know, half the reason you make a movie is for the music, and for me, I mean, it's just the best part.
Well, I've always felt that basically all filmmakers are just working for the composer.
Yes, true.
There's nothing. It's true. There's very little. I don't think there's any doubt that Steven Spielberg would have had the career that he had it not been for John Williams. It's an intangible. It's counterfactual, but it's probably true. So we all rely on that mainlined emotion that comes through music to elevate your movie. And if that goes wrong, then your whole movie might go wrong. So we were certainly fortunate to work with incredibly talented people. And the songs themselves were chosen, you know, because for the same reason that they're chosen, you know, conscientiously in any other film, is that they support the moment, both thematically and emotionally. And we were lucky enough to get the songs we wanted. You know, it costs money, but it's kind of the ballgame for us. We believe it's the ballgame. So it was... It was an important thing to
splurge on. You know, Mark, you said that when you guys went and did the interview with Don up in Telluride, that he was fully in character. Can you talk more about that? Because that's his interview is so. I mean, it's the heart of the movie. It's incredible.
It is the heart of the movie, and I have to tell you, it was a little frightening to do, because you know, David and I were sitting next to each other. David was behind the camera, and I was next to him in the chair facing Don. And Don and I were just sort of knee-to-knee doing this. And the character of Bo Cunningham is kind of a scary guy. And if you think it's intimidating watching
on screen when Don sort of does that little squint, you know, when he's really sort of, you know, staring into you. It's really terrifying when you're standing, when you're sitting right in front of him. So, and yet we had to, you know, as much as he was living that character, I had to live the character of the interviewer. But that meant really just, you know, sort of deep diving into it with Don. He, you know, it's funny. Everybody has a different working method, and there were days where Don would be sitting on that couch, you know, fully engrossed, and you know, sometimes we would do a series of questions, and we'd talk for a while, and we'd stop, and we'd say, okay, that was good, but you know, let's pick up on something you said and sort of amplify that, and we would go on and do it again. And he'd be very dialed in. There was another day or two where, in between every take, he would have the TV remote control in his hand, and he would turn on the TV to a Chicago Bulls game that he was trying to watch. So he would, in between every take, and we'd say, okay, we're ready to do the next take, and the TV would go off. And it was really, David and I were like, God, what is he doing? This is really just sort of annoying. But I think that ultimately it was part of his process, because that kind of thing kept him like out of his head. You know what I mean? It kept him from thinking too much, from looking from the outside at what he was doing, and it kept him very much sort of inside himself, without you know, sort of objectively saying, what am I doing? Am I doing this right? It was a way of sort of zenning, sort of being zened out on where he was at the time. So you know, he used a lot of techniques to sort of keep himself, you know, at that thing. And he's also, you know, Don is also, people that talk to tell from the this movie, Don's actually very, very funny as well. And there were times he would say things which we didn't know were coming, and it would just, you know, we had to redo it because we were laughing so hard. His whole monologue about how much he doesn't give a crap about the moon rocks was, I don't know how long it took us to shoot that. Because
that was almost played to an empty room.
Yeah.
We had to leave.
Yeah, just turn the camera on and walk out.
Because we couldn't be there and keep her straight.
Yeah, because he kept going and going on about the damn moon rocks. It was just ridiculous. His method was one method. Robert Pine, who plays the congressman, you know, he's an old pro. This guy was on Chips and still acts. I mean, he's Chris Pine's father, and you know, he's one of these absolute industry pros. And he took sort of a very different approach, where it was almost very. I think he's in a way so good and so practiced, and so his instrument is so available to him that he's able to take those pages and I don't know what prep he did outside of our presence, but you know, go in and just. I mean, almost one or two take wonder, just sort of lay that stuff down. So you know, and then again, everyone's different. I mean, Cindy Lou Atkins, who played the widow of Al Borden, you know, she needed, you know, it was, you kind of had to sort of get up close and personal and really, really look in her eyes and make it, you know, a one-on-one kind of thing. Everybody's sort of different, but Don's initial, you know, few days of interviews up there in that house in Telluride were really extraordinary and exhausting in a way, because it was such a high concentration effort. You know, you just really had to be listening to each other to make sure you didn't miss anything, to be able to jump on something you said that you just didn't know was coming. So it was kind of amazing. I mean, from an acting point of view, too. I mean, it's just, you know, as I say, it's pure method, because he had only the knowledge of the character that he had to guide him.
You know, you guys have had the wonderful privilege of taking the film basically across the country. Boston, you guys did Burbank, did the one in D.C., Escape Velocity, Seattle.
Yeah,
but
Seattle was great.
Can you talk about being able to bring it, you know, home to Texas, to Dallas, to Austin? You guys obviously know this area. What's it mean to bring it home to the South? And I'm guessing there will be people you know that will be there.
Well, yeah, it means a lot on a couple of different levels. First, of course, as you mentioned, Mark and I were born and reared in Dallas.
went to school there, and our grandparents had a ranch outside of Hamilton. So, you know, to that extent, Texas is in our DNA. Also, the actor who plays Al Borden is a chemistry professor now at Texas State in San Marcos. And so it's a homecoming for him as well. And then the other level, of course, is that the beating heart of NASA is down the road in Houston. So there's a confluence of a lot of different energies that make showing the film in Austin really, really special for us. And it's always fun to come home, even though I don't get back to Texas really almost ever. but it's going to be great to be back there because, of course, it's instantly familiar. And we do have friends coming from all over the states and coming into Austin to see the film at the festival. So we're really looking forward to it.
And I'll just say this, Mark's talking. Dallas, it's hard for people to necessarily remember this because almost every city now, is a collection of multiplexes. But when we were growing up in Dallas, Dallas had some extraordinary movie theaters. And, the day that I found out that they knocked down North Park was a horrible day for me. Because for those of us who grew up, during the 70s and 80s in Dallas, North Park 1 was an incredibly magical place. Not only was it this beautiful sort of modernist bit of architecture. I mean, I think people underestimated how kind of beautiful that white, sort of box was. Excuse me. But it was really a places like North Park and the Inwood and places like that were true movie temples. And David and I were there at North Park 1 for opening night of every Star Wars film. We saw everything, there. And movies were events that Dallas was second to nobody in having these great theaters. The UA Cine was an incredible theater. Even after they split it in two, the biggest house there was still a magical place. Dallas was a fantastic place to grow up and being interested in movies, because Dallas itself was a great movie place. Steven Spielberg considered the Medallion. Let's talk about classic great movie theaters of all time. The Medallion Theater was the theater that Spielberg considered to be his lucky theater, because he previewed Jaws there, and Jaws went on to be Jaws, and then he previewed Close Encounters there, and Close Encounters went on to be Close Encounters. And I think after he previewed 1941 there, he may have decided to stop going there. But, the Medallion Theater, opening night for Close Encounters in 70mm, that was it. That sealed, David and I, that sealed our fate as filmmakers. And so Dallas had these great places. And I think that's still, I was just in Dallas about 7 or 8 months ago, and I still feel it. I still feel that some of that is still there, So Dallas is highly influential in that sense. It was a great place to grow up as someone interested in movies, because it truly was a great place to go see movies. Absolutely.
Well, guys, I was blown away by the film. I love the film, and so happy to have chatted with you. I'll definitely search you guys out next week, and can't wait to see what reactions are in Austin.
Thank you very much, guys. It's been a real pleasure. That's fantastic. Thank you so much. I look forward to seeing you.
All right, guys, take it easy.
Thank you.